Welcome back to Gulf Coast Live. I'm Mike Canary. A few weeks ago, News Press storyteller and WGCU essayist Amy Bennett Williams wrote a short piece called Where Are the Swallow-Tailed Kites? It was in part a response to a Facebook post from WGCU's own John Davis about how he looks forward to his first sighting of the year of the soaring elusive birds. We're going to extend that effort today with a conversation with a man who has studied them for years. Dr. Kenneth Meyer is executive director of the Avian Research and Conservation Institute in Gainesville, Florida. This Friday, April 13th, Dr. Meyer will be presenting two free programs titled Swallow-Tailed Kites, 10,000 Miles to Survival. One's at 10 a.m., the other at 1 p.m. It's the final presentation of the 2018 Ding Darling Lecture Series at JN Ding Darling National Wildlife Refuge on Sanibel. He joins us now by phone from Gainesville. Dr. Meyer, welcome to Gulf Coast Live. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you, Mike. Glad to be here.
And we want to hear from you out there in Southwest Florida. Have you seen any swallow-tailed kites over the skies so far this year? Or maybe you've got a question about the elusive black and white birds. To join the show, give us a call now. The number is 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media. On Twitter, we're at WGCU. Just use the hashtag GCL if you'd like to ask a question or make a comment that way. Okay, Dr. Meyer, for newcomers to our area, can you describe, like, give us your best description of a swallow-tailed kite, and don't be afraid to be slightly poetic.
Oh, that's easy. Thanks. Well, it's a large bird, larger than it appears, because it's so graceful, so agile. It stays in the air virtually all day. Once it's up in the morning, it doesn't really come down until it's ready to sleep at night. It's black and white, strikingly black and white, white on the underside, except that the tail is black, the wingtips are black, and the back is black. But they have long, pointy wings that are the perfect gliding machine. Everything that humans have tried to create that would fly long distances with the least amount of energy looks a lot like a swallow-tailed kite or a barn swallow or a swift or a nighthawk, other birds that migrate long distances. And long-distance migration is a big part of the life of a swallow-tailed kite. But if you see one, you sort of get this impression that they materialize out of nowhere. And as you're marveling at how beautiful they are, they just seem to evaporate again. And that's because they wander the landscape at relatively low altitudes, looking for food, looking for other swallow-tailed kites. So, and that's usually the impression people have of them. Where are they? Oh, there they are. Oh, wait a minute, they're gone.
Right. So you answered a couple of my questions that I was going to ask. So, A, it is uncommon to see them, or it is common to see them flying and uncommon to see them not flying. And, B, they are sort of particularly soary birds. These are birds built to soar and to float around like a kite.
Absolutely.
Are they showing up later in the year? That seemed to be the anecdotal evidence from social media posts, that people didn't think they were seeing them when they normally did in the places they normally did.
That's good observations and interesting conjecture. We don't think they are. We think they're pretty consistent within a certain time period. And that time period is anywhere probably from the second week in February, as early as the 10th or 12th, people might start seeing them. In February, and depending on where you are in the state, they might not show up until the middle of March or even later. So it varies with the weather.
Are they threatened or endangered or protected on some level?
Not formally listed by the Federal Endangered Species Act. Not formally listed as endangered or threatened, but they have been treated as a bird of great conservation concern for a number of years, and for good reasons.
What are the reasons for that?
Well, in the early 1900s, people noticed them even way back, you know, 1800s, 1900s. Their nests were considered a real prize to find by egg collectors. These are Victorian-era hobbyists that actually pretty ruthless hobbyists, highly competitive, and because eggs, wild bird eggs, were very valuable for trading or for selling. Probably because of that, people were watching them, and they noticed that in the early 1900s, they started to decline, and that continued for several decades, such that by 1940, their range had contracted from 21 states all the way up into Minnesota, along the major the Mississippi Valley, and then the eastern part of the country, all the way down to Florida. But that range contracted from 21 down to 7 states by 1940, never been clear exactly why, and the bird has never recovered from that reduction.
So they were as far north as Minnesota?
Yeah, very reliable nest records.
Wow. What did their eggs look like, or what was it about their eggs that made them valuable? Were they being collected because they were pretty and they were like little jewels, or what? Give us a little bit of the backstory on that.
Yeah, you know, a lot of people think birds' eggs are all beautiful. You know, chicken eggs are pretty. They're, you know, it's that combination of shape and texture. But for swallowtail kites, they're a little unusual. They have a creamy background with large splotches of rusty or reddish brown. So I think it's a combination of the fact that they're aesthetically attractive, but also that they're hard to get. The kites nest way up in the top of the tallest trees. They've never been uniformly numerous across the eastern U.S., nor are they today in the southeast. So I think it's a combination of they're pretty and they're rare.
So what made their range get smaller? Was it human predation looking for the eggs? Was it habitat reduction? What was sort of the range of the threats to them?
Those are probably the two best guesses. This was an era when a lot of the hardwood forests, a lot of the bottomland swamp hardwood forests, all hardwoods, were being harvested at a greater rate to support the burgeoning furniture industry in the United States. So that could have been a factor, although the kites, swallowtail kites nest in pines more than hardwoods, but they'll often be within a large hardwood landscape. That's one thing. But I think just the value of the egg to collectors, the monetary value now, we're not talking about inherent value or aesthetic value. We do have a record. It's been published. It's been in some books on bird eggs. 1904, a clutch of two, what a female would lay the number of eggs. With swallowtails, it's two eggs. In 1904, sold for $40. Now, that's not corrected for inflation.
Wow.
That's, you know, you can see why collectors would go after them. And here's probably the most important fact about the swallow-tailed kite's behavior and ecology and management and conservation is that they're highly social in every season, every day of the year. And they feed together, they sleep together, they migrate together, they hang out together. And they nest in groups of two to five pairs within earshot and visual distance of each other. And so they're social in every respect. And we use this to our advantage as researchers. If we're looking to document nest outcomes, for instance, you find one nest. The best way to find another nest is to just back off so you don't disturb the birds. Sit down and wait until you see or hear another swallowtail kite. And if they're carrying nest material or carrying food, that's the easiest way to find them. You just follow them till you lose sight. You go over there. You wait till you see them again. You follow them. That might take several mornings. It might take a week or two. But as you can tell, to a lot of people, that's great sport. And it's also valuable to have that information. But if you're an egg collector, it's lucrative.
We are talking about swallow-tailed kites with Dr. Ken Meyer. He's been studying the elusive birds of prey for decades. He'll be in town this Friday for a couple of lectures at J.N. Ding Darling National Wildlife Refuge on Sanibel. If you'd like to ask a question or make a comment, give us a call now. The number is 877-428-8255. We're going to take a call now from Lisa in Port Charlotte. Lisa, welcome to Gulf Coast Live. What's your comment or question?
Well, I'm thrilled with the kites when they return every spring, and I'm lucky enough to have them nest right behind my property this year, and it's in a very tall pine tree, and I was wondering how long their gestation is, and do they have predators that can get up to the nest to snatch the eggs?
Good questions. They incubate for about 28 to 30 days, and They nest up high, usually in pine trees, and that protects them from ground predators. It's a little harder to get up, although we have a record of a yellow rat snake in Georgia going over 110 feet up a pine tree to take the two young kites, about a week old. Yeah, so that happens. And, of course, aerial predators can get at them. But it takes about a month for the eggs to hatch, and that's a vulnerable time, of course. The female's on the nest, on the eggs most of the time. The male leaves her for short periods. The female's on at night, usually, through the night, and that makes her very vulnerable to great horned owl predation. That's the biggest...
I do cap here.
You do? Okay, yeah. So
yes, I hear them.
Yeah, there's a lot of great horned owls around.
Well, I just have my fingers crossed that they'll hatch and that they'll make it.
There you go. It'll be fun to watch in any case, as long as you can watch them. And good luck. They'll finish up.
All right, Lisa, thank you very much for your call. We appreciate it.
And thank you so much.
Oh, have a great day. We also, just real quick, we got a comment from Kay on Sanibel Island answering our call for stories of sightings. She said she's been seeing swallowtail kites flying over the post office out on the island for several days now. So thanks for that information, Kay. Dr. Meyer, how did you first get started studying swallowtail kites?
I came to Florida in the mid-'80s. My wife and I had recently married, and she was in veterinary school in Gainesville, and I had finished up my PhD at the University of North Carolina and came down here, and I was looking for something to do for a couple of years until my wife finished up school. And so I started a two-year study with state funding. It was some of the earliest funding from Florida Fish and Wildlife's Non-Game Wildlife Grant Program.
And about when would this have been?
This was in 1988.
Okay.
I first started studying kites in 1988. And it was a two-year project that turned into a lifelong love and passion. So I always tell students when they're looking for projects and they say, I don't know, just something I can do in a year or two. And I say, don't ever think it might just be a year or two.
Hmm.
So, the longer you do it, the more you'll want to learn.
Absolutely. So where do they go when they're not here?
In 1996, we started putting satellite transmitters on them down in Big Cypress Swamp. Until that time, satellite transmitters had just been invented, but they were large. However, by 1996, they became small enough so that swallowtail kite could carry it. We're limited to 3% of the bird's body weight by law, by permit.
Okay.
So 1996, we tagged six birds in Big Cypress, adults at nests, and the offspring of one of those females. And within 2 months, we saw their whole 5,000-mile migration play out, receiving their locations every day by email. And we found that they go to South Central South America, Southern Brazil. We had no idea that that's where they went, or no one had any idea how they migrated, the route that they took. And it turns out to be very interesting and very consistent from year to year, highly consistent.
So for all those years, there were bird watchers in Brazil wondering where these swallowtail kites went to.
Right, yeah. And that's right, where they came from and where they went to. But to confuse things, there is a South American population and a breeding population in Brazil that is probably the evolutionary origin of the U.S. population. The U.S. population is pretty small, but they also nest in Central America and throughout South America. Down to about as far south as the U.S. birds go for the winter. So they all mix together in the winter. And had a wonderful employee, student, Audrey Washburn, who actually had dual citizenship. The first year we put satellite transmitters out, we had no idea where they'd go. They went to Brazil, and within a month, Audrey and a colleague went down there. Because of her citizenship, she had access, easy access, and they started hearing the radio signals. These are old-fashioned radio signals that we tagged a bunch of young birds with just VHF radio transmitters. And she started hearing the signals of birds that just a month and a half before she had held and helped attach radios to. So we got there because of the satellite data that showed us where they were going in general. And then we went there and found individuals that we knew particularly well.
How refined has the satellite tracking become? Are you able to track individual birds in real time these days?
Almost real time. It comes in pretty quickly, but these little devices now have evolved to the point where they carry a GPS receiver. So they're getting highly accurate location data within 15 or 20 meters at the most. And so they take a fix every 2 hours. It's stored every 2 days. It's sent up to satellites, 1,000 miles up at least, and then a company takes that data, process it, sells it to us. It's a very expensive process. The transmitters cost $3,500, $4,000 each. It costs $100 a month for the data from each radio. However, we have no other way, and we still have no other way, to get this level of accuracy and important information. And even if we could sail boats and fly airplanes long enough to track them by radio signal from the old-fashioned transmitters. It wouldn't be cost-effective. There's no way we could do it.
What's it like for someone like you who's done this for so long to see technology advance this far? And part two of that question is what will, can you imagine what might be next to where the way you're doing it now is the old way?
Yeah. Well, we all know that we could never say that that we're at the ultimate point. We haven't reached the pinnacle yet, although it's hard to believe. I think your question about real time is a good one. Having the same scale of information, you know, being able to tell a bird's 5,000 miles away what tree it's sitting in.
Yeah.
I mean, we can see when these individual birds use the same tree night after night. I don't know how you can get much better than that except faster delivery and cheaper price.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Smaller and cheaper, you know, more birds tagged, that sort of thing.
Yeah, and one of the advances is that now instead of using satellites, they have devices that can take the same GPS information and send it to cell phone towers. And so that's a less expensive process, but the transmitters don't last as long. The ones we've been using are made by a company called Microwave Telemetry. They pioneered all the satellite tracking that I can think of. And they're the ones that got us to this point. We use their transmitters right from the start. That's not a promotion. It's just I'm amazed. And these were produced by someone who was a PhD waterfowl biologist, Paul Howey, because of his passion for learning about birds and contributing to conservation. So we've been using those devices, and Paul now has a transmitter that weighs just 2 grams. The ones on swallowtails are 17 grams.
Wow.
So we now have transmitters small enough to put on, for instance, mangrove cuckoos, we started studying on Ding Darling with the support of the Friends Association, the Ding Darling Wildlife Society, and the Refuge, of course. They're really interested in this. I mean, so many high-class, high-quality birders have not seen mangrove cuckoos because they're so difficult to find. But we've started tagging some of them on a small scale to see if they migrate and where they go, because the species may be declining. And we don't know everything. We don't really know much about their biology at all.
We only have about a minute left, but is it possible for you to demonstrate for us what a swallowtail kite's call sounds like?
That's the dreaded question for people. Okay, here's a breeding call. So this, you hear this now. You hear this around nests in the morning. Chee, 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 chee. And it's usually done between the members of the pair, but sometimes it can be between males. And it's usually accompanied by this beautiful dive. One bird gets behind the other. They're flying, and all of a sudden, as if in unison, it's very balletic. They just head toward the ground at high speed, pull up at the last minute, calling as they go. The alarm call is kind of a coo, 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 something like that, higher pitched and much more musical.
Well, thank you for singing for us. And that is all the time we have. I want to thank my guest, Dr. Kenneth Myers, Executive Director of the Avian Research and Conservation Institute in Gainesville. He'll be on Sanibel this Friday for a couple of lectures at J.N. Ding Darling National Wildlife Refuge. You can find out more on our website, gulfcoastlive.org, including a picture of a swallow-tailed kite not flying, taken by News Press photographer Andrew West. Thank you, Andrew. And Dr. Meyer, thank you for your time. I really enjoyed our conversation.
Me too, Mike. You're very welcome.
Our show today was produced by Julie Glenn, Rachel Iacovone, and myself. Our director is Richard Chinqui. Our social media coordinator is Tara Callaghan. Gulf Coast Live is made possible through the generous support of the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. For now, thanks for listening. I'm Mike Canary. This is WGCU-FM Fort Myers 90.1, WMKO Marco Island 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.